If I say to you that I have been looking forward to tonight, I would not be lying to you. I have been thinking about this actually for a couple months and looking forward to it. So I thank you for letting me be back, and I thank you for coming yourselves, especially on a night like tonight, with the rain and the darkness and all of those negative things to keep you home where it's nice and comfortable, and you have chosen to be here. So I thank you, each one and all. When I first walked in, someone teased me. I knew I was right at home when they did. They said, "Well, we see that you brought your Cedarville cheerleaders with you." And I said, "No, they're already here. They got here before I did." And then when I walked in, they said, "Well, we just want you to know, we did not come here to support you. We came here to heckle you." So if you hear some kind of heckling from the peanut gallery back there, you know where it's coming from. Actually, they remind me of a story of a pastor and his deacon. The deacon was a very loyal person to that pastor, and it didn't matter where the pastor was preaching, the deacon would always show up. And the pastor was so impressed by this friendship. So one winter, the pastor was invited to preach in northern Minnesota. And as you might guess, it was not only cold, but it was a terribly snowy night. A winter storm up there in northern Minnesota. The only people who actually showed up was the inviting preacher and the pastor and the deacon. And so they decided, well, you know, I guess we'll go ahead and do this. So the pastor preached and got all done, and he went to the back, and the deacon came out and greeted him. And the pastor said, "Oh, you know, I just have to tell you, your friendship is just marvelous. You know, you're just so loyal, and you're always here, and I appreciate it." He said, "No, you got it all wrong, Pastor. My mother told me that every preacher has at least one good sermon in him, and when you preach it, I want to be there." So I think that's why they're here. I haven't hit that yet. Some of you are new to me, at least. I don't know you, and this is not your first time here, probably, but first time here with me, and I thank you for being here, and I welcome you, and trust that what we do together will be interesting enough and helpful enough to bring you back. But I do thank you all for being here tonight. As you may know, we are not going to meditate through Matthew, Mark, march through Mark, lunge through Luke, jog through John, or ambulate through Acts. Nor are we going to roam through Romans or carouse through 1 Corinthians, nor are we going to gallop through Galatians or ease our way through Ephesians, nor are we going to philander through Philippians. We're also not going to clamber through Colossians, and we're not going to thread our way through 1 Thessalonians or 2 Thessalonians. We're not going to tiptoe through 1 Timothy, 2 Timothy, or Titus. We're not going to file our way through Philemon or hurry through Hebrews. We've already done that. We're not going to jam our way through James, nor are we going to pilfer our way through 1 or 2 Peter. We're not going to jog through 1 John, 2 John, 3 John, Jude. There you got it, 3 John and Jude. Nor are we going to revel in the revelation. Rather, we are going to carouse together through 2 Corinthians. 2 Corinthians. So if you have your Bible, obviously I invite you to join me there. I have been living with 2 Corinthians for a long time. Way back in the summer, I started this. At least summer seemed like a long time ago. And I've waded through two commentaries, and I'm in a third one. How a person can write over 500 pages on about 8 pages and 13 chapters is a miracle to me. But I have been struggling my way to get with him. But nevertheless, I have lived with 2 Corinthians now for quite a little while, and I'm eager to get going with you in that book. I think whenever you introduce something like this, people should ask, well, why in the world are you going to choose that book? There are 66 books total. You know, there's 65 other ones. You could have chosen another one. Why in the world this one? And I think that is a very good question. I take a few minutes here to answer that question. Why did I choose 2 Corinthians with its 13 chapters? Probably there are lots of answers to that. I've jotted down 6 of them, as a matter of fact, and there's probably even more. But a couple of personal reasons. I've never taught or preached my way through 2 Corinthians before. So this is a something brand new for me. And that's part of the reason I wanted to do it, just to kind of stretch myself out a little bit and do something new to me. That's probably better for you in a way. At least you're not getting rehashed sermons or secondhand things that were designed principally for another group. This is brand new to me. And so that means I'll probably goof a few times, maybe more than a few. But that's part of the reason I wanted to do it, just because I had never done it before. So that's reason one. Reason number two is because, according to many people, 2 Corinthians is Paul's most difficult letter to understand. I venture to guess that you may never have heard a series of messages on 2 Corinthians. I don't really know. I have not done it myself. Perhaps you have, and if so, fine. But this is a very difficult book. And in that sense, then, it is a challenge. It's kind of like, whoa, there are some verses here. There are some expressions here. There's a relationship going on here that is challenging, to say the least. And so because of that, those two reasons, very personal things to me, I thought, well, okay, let's tackle this. Let's see what we can do with it. Obviously, the goal is to get done, and the goal is to understand what Paul is doing, as well as to apply and learn from it for our own lives. But it's going to be a little bit of a stretch, I think, for me and probably for you as well, because of the difficulty of the book. If you say, well, why is it such a difficult book? It's really difficult because of the relationship that was going on between the Corinthian believers on the one hand and Paul on the other. This is a very, and it's an appropriate term for tonight, this was a very stormy relationship. There were a lot of misunderstandings. There were a lot of assumptions. And to kind of really throw a monkey into the middle of the works, a monkey wrench into the middle of the works, you had some people that I'm going to call Paul's detractors. Commentaries call them that. It's a good title. Essentially, they were men who were false religious teachers. They seemed to dog Paul's steps wherever he went. And he would found churches and get things going in the right direction. And then, as you may know, these gentlemen would show up sometime later and begin to mess up what Paul had started. And they did their dirty work all over Galatia, as you may know, and certainly in Corinth. And when you get these three dynamics, these three groups going, as it were, you have the Corinthians themselves, who were relatively young in the faith, as you can understand, in that first generation. And then you have Paul traveling hither and thither. They didn't have cell phones and regular landlines and, you know, communication ability as we have today. And then you have this other group in the middle that's trying to pull the Corinthians away from Paul and toward themselves. you can understand then why this is such a difficult book. And some of the passages, you don't quite know to whom Paul is speaking. Is he speaking to the Corinthian church in general? Is he speaking to these detractors in particular? And then in one of the commentaries I was reading, you have another little twist in all of that, and simply to say that some of the Corinthian believers were very faithful and loyal to Paul, and some were not. And so you have even a division within the congregation itself. And how large that division or split was, we really do not know. Simply put, this is a tough book. And it's difficult because of the struggle, the stormy struggle in the relationship that Paul had with these folks. You know, Paul traveled the Greco-Roman world of his day, and he established lots of churches. And he had a beautiful, trusting relationship with the vast majority of them. As a matter of fact, Pat and I were at our son's church this morning in Bellefontaine, and the pastor was preaching this month on the book of Philippians and talking about the Philippian church. And when you read that letter and you read commentaries on the church at Philippi, you soon come to realize that this was Paul's sweetheart church. There was hardly a ripple between him and the Philippian believers. There was so much love and so much trust, and that was a church that supported him financially, as many of you would know. But not all of the churches were of that stripe. And the relationship that Paul wanted to have with all of the churches was not always ideal. And certainly in Corinth, there was no... It was just a tough situation, and the book here is a little difficult for that reason. That's the second reason why I wanted to tackle it. Here's the third reason, and this is perhaps more to the point of what 2 Corinthians is really all about. This is a book that deals with the relationship between pastor and people, or people and pastor. And that was part of the reason I wanted to bring it to you. You are experienced, seasoned believers. That is not an insult. That is a compliment. You are people who have been here, most of you, for a good long time. And you have sat under several different pastors here. Not just senior pastors, but associates, etc. My time with you goes back quite a few years, and I can remember very wonderful pastors here and associate pastors. Certainly, I'm not going to name them all because I can't. Larry Fetzer certainly was a wonderful gentleman, and I followed him ultimately, not just as the interim here, but as a state rep in Ohio. And I'm thinking of Jim Neely. What a wonderful man Jim Neely was. And so gracious and so practical and just reaching out all over the world, literally, if you know Jim Neely. And you've had all kinds, it seems to me. And I'm going to say this because it's probably true. You've liked some better than others. And you've struggled with some more than with others. And yet, here you sit. And you know something of what it takes in a two-way, almost tug-of-war back and forth with a pastor, an associate pastor, and the people. And this book is all about that. And therefore, it seems to me very appropriate to you. Very appropriate. People need to think a little bit of how they think about their pastor. And they need to understand what is going on in the heart of a godly pastor and what really is important to him or should be. And so it just seems to me this is an appropriate book for all of us, really. So it deals with that pastor-people relationship. And for that reason, we need to sit down and think about it and try to understand it and kind of put ourselves in some of these shoes and walk in them a little bit from time to time. The fourth thing that calls me to this book, because of the nature of the book, what I've just tried to describe, this book tells us an awfully lot about Paul, the Apostle Paul. You know, you can read about Paul in the book of Acts, and you kind of get one impression of Paul in the book of Acts. I think an accurate impression from all of his travels and troubles. You start reading the epistles, you get a slightly different look at Paul. And we find out travels, troubles, thoughts, priorities. Wow. I myself happen to be a fan of the Apostle Paul. I have to kind of drag myself away from his books and to preach other things. I could stay there for a long time. But there's an awful lot in here about the Apostle Paul and what made him tick that really is not revealed in any other place. And therefore, we'll take a look at this. And we'll learn something not only about pastor-people relationship, but we're going to learn an awful lot about the pastor, about Paul himself. And lest I give you a false impression, I don't want to do that. Pastors today are not apostles. And the apostle of that day was not the same as a pastor. Most assuredly, Paul had in common with pastors of our day this marvelous pastoral heart and spirit, this love for people and love for the church and a desire for people to grow and develop and folks to get saved and the church to come together and stay together. Those are pastoral loves and hearts and thoughts, and certainly the Apostle Paul had all of that. But Paul was an apostle. And that apostolic calling gave him a level of authority that people needed to fear. And we don't quite have that as pastors. Maybe you're afraid of your pastor, that's okay. But not because he could call down the divine judgment on you and end your life. There's a little difference here. Okay, a couple more thoughts, if I may. I wanted to also take us to this book because of some rather famous passages within it. There are some wonderful texts in here that are worthy of entire messages in and of themselves. You'll notice in chapter 1, that very famous book where he, and I'm not going to try to quote it, where he says, "Blessed be God who comforts us in all of our troubles in which we are comforted so that we enjoy the comfort of God so we can in turn turn around and comfort others." How many of God's people have been comforted by that verse or two? Who helped them to understand why it is I am suffering. And I may not know all about it, but I know the Lord is allowing this so I can turn around and help somebody else. That's a great verse in chapter 1. I'm thinking of chapter 3, right at the end of chapter 3, verse 17, 18. "Now the Lord is that Spirit. Where the Spirit of the Lord is, there is liberty. But we all," speaking of the believer, "but we all with an unveiled face, beholding as in a glass the glory of the Lord, are being changed into the same image from glory to glory, even as by the Spirit of the Lord." Oh my. I wrote a book about those two verses, a little Sunday school book, I don't know, 80, 90, 100 pages, called "Choosing to Be Spiritual." And it's based on those two verses and the marvelous privilege that we have as God's people to be gradually changed into the likeness of Christ by the power of the Holy Spirit as we observe God's glory in His Word. Those verses are beautiful and powerful. Chapter 3, when you think about chapter 5, 2 Corinthians chapter 5, talks about, he describes our body as simply a tent, a frail, temporary tent. But he says, we know that when this tent is finally laid to rest, we're going home. And we have a beautiful, permanent home where there is stability and rest, etc. And I can't or do not need to go into all of it. But he talks about this marvelous transition that is coming from this earthly life into our heavenly home, and where we will see the Lord and face the Lord, but we will be there safe and sound. I appreciated what the young man prayed a moment ago about those folks in Texas. They went to church this morning. They ended up going to heaven. And they are probably rejoicing. I don't know, I can't be 100% about that. But their earthly tent. And now they are with the Lord. You get that famous verse there, absent from the body, present with the Lord. And as honestly, as I age, and I presume as you age, you begin to realize more and more the truthfulness that we do live in a weak tent. And this body is breaking down, and we need to be rescued from that and have an eternal home, not made with hands. I go too far. Chapter 5. Chapters 8 and 9 together are marvelous. They're probably the central passage in the New Testament on giving. God loves a hilarious, joyful giver. Where'd that come from? 2 Corinthians 8 and 9. It's just a marvelous text on stewardship and giving. And then finally, and we'll return to this one in chapter 12, even as a kid, I remember our pastor preaching on this, and that one verse, my grace is sufficient for you. For my strength is made perfect in weakness. And Paul then responds, most gladly, therefore, would I rather glory in my infirmities, that the power of Christ may rest upon me. There ain't any other place in the New Testament that talks like that. Of course, Paul's experience in the third heaven and all of that is the backdrop. So these famous, I think, and meaningful passages draw us to this book. And for that reason, I think we ought to be there and give ourselves to it. The final thought that I have, perhaps I have already said it, but I'll say it one more time because I wrote it down here in a separate thought. This is a book that opens the door on Paul's inner thinking for us. His motivation, what he expected of himself, what he expected of others, his relationship to the Lord. Paul just kind of opens up and unloads himself on the reader. And it is very emotional at times. And it is very difficult to understand at times, just as emotions often are. But we do get ushered into Paul's inner sanctum of his heart and life, and we're going to go right there and learn with him. So for those reasons, we are going to spend our time in 2 Corinthians. I have counted up, we have about 16 Sunday nights, something like that. It depends on, you know, we get together and then we quit, and then we get together and we quit, and we've stopped for this and go there and so on. And I myself will be gone a bit more this time. So probably 16 sessions. And we'll do our best to stay on task and to finish and treat the whole book with an equality rather than go too deep early on and then rush to get through to the end. To try to do that. Okay. All of that to say thank you for being here. I hope I haven't blown you away or sent you out the door dejected. I'll never come back here again. I hope you will at least understand why in the world I have chosen this book for us these weeks. I do remember when I pastored there in Warren, Ohio, it came time to nominate deacons. I've learned that officer nomination time can become a tense time in a family, in a local church. One of the men went to talk to a former deacon, a man who had not been on the board recently. And he said, "Well, are you willing to run again?" And the response that he got went something like this: "Well, there's no way that I am going to run to be on that deacon board after what Pastor Warren did." Well, the gentleman who heard those words came back to me and said, "This is what he said." I was shocked. I was stunned. And my first question to myself was, what in the world did I do? What have I done? Interestingly enough, this was months before. Whatever I had done was months before. And the gentleman had never said a word to me about it. As far as I knew, everything was fine until that moment when the report came back. "I'll not serve on that board after what Pastor Warren did." Well, what do? You realize that when you're a pastor, that relationship of, I'm going to use the word trust, because I think that's the guts of it, that relationship of trust is inviolable. You if people don't trust you, and I'm sure I've said this to you before, if people don't trust you, they will never listen to you. And they will never learn from you. And they will never follow you. That you have to guard that trust. And so I thought, well, all right. Come to find out from another conversation that he thought, that gentleman thought, that I had kind of pulled a fast business meeting. That our Constitution demanded that all business meetings be announced 2 weeks in advance. Which is fine. You do try to stay with the Constitution and obey it. But he thought that I had not done that because I had another agenda. I was really trying to get at somebody in the congregation, one of his friends. And he had no idea what my agenda was, but that's what he thought it was. And he thought that I had called for a quick business meeting so that people could be would be ill-prepared and maybe even have a low attendance, and then I would get what I wanted. You never think like that, do you? So I thought, okay, I don't think I did that, but let's check this out a bit. So I went to our file, and I had kept records of our church bulletins, all the bulletins. So I pulled out the bulletins from back then, and I took them to him. And I said, okay, here's, you know, you have this two-week lag. Well, here's the bulletin. It was printed in the bulletin. Here it was. Now 2 weeks later, here's the bulletin, and it's announced. We have the meeting. We had it. He apologized to me, but I want to tell you, from that incident on, I just never sensed that there was a trust and a friendship and a warmth like there had been before. That is, how do I say this? That is personally hurtful to a pastor. That is when you think that there is actually somebody who doesn't trust you. But beyond that personal sense of hurt, which, by the way, you have to get over, is a deeper hurt that here is a person now who probably doesn't really want to be involved in the work of the Lord. And here is a person who is much more quick to criticize and to divide and to pull things away than to get on board and be enthusiastic about whatever. So you can have a personal hurt, but then there's a pastoral hurt for the good of the church. Paul felt some of that. And that is where this book of 2 Corinthians comes into play. I'm going to give you just a little outline of it. I think this one word will tie the whole book for us. Paul is on the defensive. He is on the defensive because of the Corinthians themselves and the questions and wonderings and waverings that they have. But he's also on the defensive because of these detractors who are making a bad situation worse by all of their accusations and innuendos. And so the title, On the Defensive. I have put together the book, or I should say perhaps the book is put together, along these lines. Please forgive the M's. I couldn't resist some of that. Some of it does fit. Paul is going to defend his movements, first of all, because they question his movements. You said you were coming back and you didn't do it. Why not? Why not? When people start asking you why kinds of questions, you know they're getting at something far more than just your actions or motions. They're getting at your motivations, the reason why you do things. So he defends in chapter 1 and part of 2 his movements because they question him about it. Again, and it was what I just said was true. You said you were coming back and then you changed your mind. If you were really spirit-led, you wouldn't be changing your mind, buddy. Second, he has to defend his ministry. Chapter 2 through 7, a rather large section, really. Paul will say to the Corinthian believers and his detractors that he is a legitimate apostle with a legitimate ministry. As a matter of fact, he will contrast the ministry of Moses in the Old Testament with the Old Covenant with the law written on tablets of stone. On the one side, he contrasts Moses with the Pauline apostleship with not the Old Covenant, but the New Covenant, not of the law, but of grace, not written on tablets of stone, but written on human hearts, tablets of flesh, and not with a pen of iron or even the finger of God, but with the Spirit of God. And Paul is saying, hey, I have a very legitimate ministry. And in contrast to Moses, Moses' ministry was a fading glory ministry. As you know, when he came down from the mountain, having received the law, his face was glowing, reflecting the glory and the beauty of God. And then that glory gradually began to fade, and so he covered his face so people wouldn't see the fade from time to time when they saw him, and he wouldn't be embarrassed by it. Paul picks up on that and says, well, Moses' ministry was a fading glory kind. Mine is a growing glory kind of ministry. 2 Corinthians 3:18, we are transformed into the same image from glory to glory. Not fading, but growing glory. Where was I? Oh, yeah, he was defending his ministry. Chapters 8 and 9, I alluded to this offering for the poor saints in Jerusalem. I think as a New Testament reader and as a kid in school, church and then even as a college student, seminary student, I never really attached much significance to that offering. It was like, okay, Paul did it. It was nice. He remembered the poor. He was kind. Paul had a much different rationale for that offering. And he certainly wanted all of the Gentile churches to participate generously in this offering for those Jewish brethren there in Jerusalem, because he saw this not simply as being nice to poor people, which it was, but he saw this as a visible, tangible expression of the new unity between Jew and Gentile in the church. And that was such a big thing to him. That is what took him to Jerusalem ultimately near the end of his public ministry to deliver that offering, even though it put him at risk. And he was ultimately, as you know, arrested. He's going to defend his motives, chapter 10 through most of chapter 12. And you got, I might as well say it, when you read the commentaries, some are saying, you know, these last chapters are so harsh. They're so direct. They're so pointed. They couldn't really be a part of the first nine chapters. You know, this got to be another book, and somehow this got appended to it. It's like, whoa! But he is very pointed in saying, I am an apostle, and not just an apostle, but don't misconstrue my sufferings. Do not think because I have suffered, and Paul suffered like crazy, as you know, and he even details that in this book like in no other. But he says, do not misconstrue my sufferings as either weakness on my part or the fact that God is not pleased with me. Paul would not have bought into what we call today the health and wealth gospel, where if you're really sincere in the things of the Lord and you have enough faith, God will bless you and you'll have all kinds of money and you'll have health and your family will be happy and whoo-hoo. And all of these things are kind of evidences that you are that God is really blessing and pleased with you. Paul could not... What did Paul glory in? His sufferings. And he says, hey, I want you to know, I got good reason for going through all this. Don't misconstrue my motivation. And then finally, there at the very end, he kind of gets them ready for his arrival. He's going to come back. It will be at least Paul's third time in Corinth. And basically, I don't know how to say this, it won't sound good. He says, you know, you better be ready when I get there. Some of you just need to repent. Some of you are saying, well, he's kind of he's really forceful in his writings, but when he actually shows up physically, he's kind of a wimp. Paul says, listen, when I get there, I will not be a wimp. You will not want me to come as an authoritative apostle into your presence. And I want you to know, you better get ready now before I arrive because you won't like what you see and hear and get when I do arrive. This is very pointed. That's why I felt I had to say something about the different level of authority between a present-day pastor and an apostle. It's quite a little difference. Okay. Let's look at one text and then we're out of here. Okay. Do you know how hard this is? I am turning pages and skipping stuff. Let's go to 2 Corinthians 12. Okay. We'll just go right there for a minute. We'll come back to it, obviously. I thank you again for your patience with me, and I'm just trying to motivate you a little bit, cause you to come back, not scare you. And I would like you to even maybe think about reading the book once. Ooh, doggy, wouldn't that be a miracle? 2 Corinthians chapter 12. I think I'll start at verse 7, okay? Here we go. This is I'm picking this passage because it actually climaxes a theme. There aren't many themes that run through this book, but this is one of them. 12:7. Lest I should be exalted above measure for the abundance of the revelations, a thorn in the flesh was given to me, a messenger of Satan to buffet me, lest I be exalted above measure. Concerning this thing, I pleaded with the Lord 3 times that it might depart from me. He said to me, my grace is sufficient for you, for my strength is made perfect in weakness. And then Paul responds, therefore, most gladly, I will rather boast in my infirmities that the power of Christ may rest upon me. Therefore, I take pleasure in infirmities, in reproaches, in needs, in persecutions, in distresses for Christ's sake. For when I am weak, then I am strong. Doesn't that sound like craziness? Strength through weakness. I don't like that. I would rather feel competent. I would rather say, well, this is going to be bad, so just kind of hang on. I would rather say, hey, look, I have a good education. I've been through Cedarville University. I've been through Dallas Seminary. I have 8 years, etc. I think I can make things happen for God. No. Well, I have a good personality. I get along well with people. I'm a nice guy. No. I can preach. I can handle the English language. The Lord has given me a good mind. Go for it. People are going to get saved just because of me. No. You see, it's the reverse. It's this upside down kingdom again. It's this like, okay, you're really strong when you sense your weakness. Even though you fight against your weakness and you don't want to admit your weakness, and the Lord even keeps you in situations of weakness, but it's in your weakness that His strength comes to bear. As a matter of fact, His strength and His power cannot flow through us as long as we are consumed with our own strength and ability. That's crazy. But that's true, isn't it? If you've ever, and you have, you've taught classes, you've preached sermons, you've sung songs, you've played instruments, you've put on cantatas and all kinds of things. And for all of that, you practice and you write and you study and you worry and you pray and you think and you prepare. But when push comes to shove and it all has to happen, there's a tremendous sense of weakness that should come over us. Lord, if you don't do this, it ain't going to happen. Maybe that's a crazy place to end, but it is where we're going to end. And it is a theme, not just of Paul's life and not just of the book of 2 Corinthians. It actually is a theme of the Christian experience. Embrace your weakness and allow God's power to flow through you. Not in spite of it, but because of it. Father, would you help us? We have a lot to think about in this book and a lot to learn about Paul and about life and about ministry and about relationship. We don't want to say things that aren't true or aren't biblical or aren't helpful. But we do want to expose ourselves to your truth. Thank you that Paul was actually forced to write this book because of what was going on in Corinth. And we have it. So we thank you even for that trouble that he went through, so we would have a little more information about him and thus about ourselves and how to live the Christian life. I pray you'll whet a bit of an appetite within each one of us that we might enjoy, that we might absorb, that we might learn, that we might be better because of our time together. I pray in Jesus' name. Amen. Okay.